Sunshine to come on Saturday, although there will be a little bit of rain edging into the far northwest of Scotland. And then for Easter Day itself, it looks like England and parts of Wales could see outbreaks of rain moving in. That's the latest weather. Alan.
Thank you, Chris. This is BBC Radio 4, where now Dejan Sujic, the director of the Design Museum in London, reads another extract from his book, B is for Bauhaus.
B is for Bauhaus is a look at the modern world in ideas and objects. Today, it's K is for Kitchen and how I got started in Acton. K is for Kitchen. In the early 20th century, the middle-class kitchen was at the front line of a particularly bitter variety of class warfare, carried out for the most part in conditions every bit as constricted as those endured by the sappers digging under the trenches of the Somme. It was a conflict between maids, expected to remain invisible in the background of the intricate domestic arrangements of the families they worked for, and their scarcely less constrained employers, for whom every act of daily life was carried out with a spectator present. The scale of a country house had allowed for manoeuvre, with back stairs, green baize doors, and servants' halls mitigating the claustrophobic aspects of domesticity. But a suburban kitchen crammed the combatants in territory in which every square inch was contested. The kitchen, whatever its size, was a kind of buffer zone. It was like the boiler room of a ship, populated by crew rather than passengers. With a few exceptions, its design was pragmatic and utilitarian rather than an aesthetic statement. But this variety of simplicity had a growing appeal. The kitchen was the route through which electrical and mechanical appliances started filtering into the home. Given the association of machinery with work, it was a sensitive process. Throughout the 19th century, those who could afford to kept work and home entirely separate. To be able to do so was a reflection of social status. Early wireless sets and gramophones were camouflaged as furniture for fear that in their raw state, they could compromise the domesticity of the home. The kitchen was the most mechanized part of the home, the place in which order and method were seen as desirable. The contemporary kitchen is the product of the mingling of these two worlds that came when domesticity flooded through the bulkhead to colonize what had once been no man's land. The kitchen has become the symbolic center of the home in a way that it never used to be, a domestic shrine to the idea of family life and conviviality. But it's also a place in which the conspicuous celebration of efficiency has acquired a symbolic value. If Terence Conran helped to make the kitchen a fashionable alternative to the living room, Margarita Schutte-Lihotzky, a Viennese architect and lifelong revolutionary socialist, is paradoxically responsible for its underlying organizational principles. In the 1920s, she combined egalitarianism with logic and devised the Frankfurt kitchen, a concept that has the claim to be the mother of all fitted kitchens. As many as 8,000 were installed in flats built for Frankfurt's workers by the city. She was influenced by the theories of time in motion and by a determination to lay the production line out so efficiently that the worker became an integral part of it. In 1916, she was one of the first women to study architecture at the Vienna Academy of Applied Art. She claimed, "What attracted me to architecture was the very concrete task of serving the people." The First World War triggered a traumatic social upheaval in post-imperial Vienna. The city was struggling to accommodate a flood of refugees. Schutte-Lihotzky toured squatter shacks, working with their inhabitants to install running water and electricity. It was at the height of the influenza epidemic that killed 20 million people in 1918. This clearly played an important part in impressing on the early modern movement pioneers the urgency of making hygiene an essential part of their program. Her designs had to work within the constraints of minimal space. Her kitchens had neat rows of storage bins and racks and work surfaces designed to be easy to clean. When I was a child in Acton in the 1950s, our kitchen was a scullery just big enough for two people to stand up in, with a gas oven, a sink, and no refrigerator, in a disorganized version of her galley. She moved to the Soviet Union in 1930 to plan settlements for Stalin's great utopia. When purges and show trials made life impossible there, she went to Istanbul. In 1940, she returned to Austria, but was caught by the Gestapo and sentenced to 15 years in a labor camp. Liberated in 1945, she worked in East Germany and in Cuba, as well as in Austria, designing social housing, nursery schools, children's furniture, and exhibition systems. It's not for designing any single house that she will be remembered, but for the radical approach she brought to understanding how ordinary people related to life in the homes that architects designed. She was one of the first to insist on the responsibility that architects must have to their real clients, not the government bureaucracy responsible for social housing, but the people who would live in it. Despite her devotion to the proletariat, it is the kitchen that has become the greatest domestic class signifier of them all. What you eat, where and when you eat, and how and who prepares it, provide the most intimate portrait of any individual. N is for national identity. The techniques by which identity is manufactured and which constitute a key aspect of the practice of design have always fascinated me. I remember wondering why the 1,000 dinar note in what was once called Yugoslavia, where I spent summers as a child, came with an image of a steel worker in cap and overalls posed in front of a blast furnace on one side and a cluster of burning torches and red stars on the other. In Britain, money was signified by representations of 18th century notables with whiskers and sizable wigs, along with portraits of the Queen. In 2007, I was billed to discuss national identity at Belgrade's first ever design festival. The hotel and the hulking conference centre wrapped around it, where the festival was based, were the high watermark of Marshal Tito's Yugoslavia. The architect toured convention centres in the West and learnt enough to design a huge glass-skinned box with an uncomfortable resemblance to a giant fan heater. It was hardly beautiful, but with one bound, a notionally communist state had introduced those of its people with access to hard currency to five-star hotels and shopping malls, even if none of the international chains, which usually populated them, were allowed into the country. Even now, identity is not an entirely comfortable subject to bring up in Belgrade. The cable channel in my hotel room played a continuous loop of films celebrating Serbia's armies marching to victory in the Balkan Wars of 1912, with text messages of support for Karadzic and Mladic rolling out at the bottom of the screen. I scratched whole paragraphs from the talk I had planned to give. Architecture had played its part in the lead-up to the conflict in Yugoslavia, but going into too much detail in this setting didn't seem like a good idea. The Croats and Serbs engaged in a bout of competitive church building in order to lay claim to disputed areas. The Catholic Croats built demonstratively modern churches in concrete and glass. The Orthodox Serbs built equally demonstrative Byzantine domed traditional structures in stone and tile. The message was not just about which community an area belonged to. Such a use of architectural style can be described as a kind of cultural nationalism. All the Marxist states were inculcated with the political uses of culture. Once the wars of Yugoslav succession had started, the obverse side of this policy was the deliberate destruction of the architectural landmarks of the peoples that the Serb extremists were trying to destroy. After the other warring parties in the former Yugoslavia joined in, the Croats, Bosnian Muslims, and Kosovans engaged in rounds of mutual destruction. Minarets in Bosnia were blown up by the Serbs. Mostar's medieval bridge was destroyed by Croats. The National Library in Sarajevo, with its collection of precious books, was obliterated by Bosnian Serbs. This was not the time or the place to bring any of it up, and I stuck instead to architectural politics well away from the Balkans. When the F-16s were in the skies of Serbia, I was in Glasgow worrying about design exhibitions. In the few moments that I did think about Belgrade, I believed that bombing was the only way for NATO to stop a bloodbath in Kosovo. Now I know a bit more about what it felt like to be on the ground, waiting for the bombs, an experience faced by two of my uncles and their wives.
and it posed a question of identity far sharper than anything I had experienced in Scotland. As a prominent Englishman working in Scotland, have you ever experienced any examples of racial prejudice? It was the kind of question to which there is no right answer. It was put to me by a reporter from The Scotsman the morning after the country had voted for a devolved parliament of its own in Edinburgh. I didn't know whether to feel flattered by the attention, or in a subtle way, mildly humiliated. Was I being told that I didn't belong? Certainly, it made me realise how much people judge who or what you are by how you sound, rather than what you say. And in Glasgow, there is no doubt that, despite having a name which most English people, never mind Scots, need a certain amount of coaching to pronounce, I did sound pretty English. Clearly, an accent is an essential part of anybody's identity, and mine is the product of growing up in London in the 50s and 60s with parents who didn't speak English as a first language. It's the product of a constant diet of the BBC Home Service, the authentic sound of received pronunciation in the incarnation of Daphne Oxenford, boomed out of a beige plastic wireless set to invite me to listen with Mother every afternoon. "Are you sitting comfortably?" Daphne would ask. "Then I'll begin." I was fluent in BBC English, as well as my parents' Serbo-Croat. Heaven knows how they felt at producing an offspring whose ever so slightly snotty version of English would have made them feel how acutely foreign they were becoming to me every time I opened my mouth. I used English to blend as much as I could into a suburban London that still had milk bottles delivered every morning on a horse-drawn float steered by a man in a peaked cap. We lived in a modest semi-detached house on a quiet suburban street where coal was delivered every autumn, poured one sack at a time by a muscled man in a flat cap into the cellar through a hole in the pavement with a cast-iron lid. I never really understood how my parents would have seen their lives in London. My father worked for the World Service, reading the news in front of one of those big old microphones hanging on coiled springs in a metal circle. He had an upright typewriter to write his bulletins, which he would pound away on with two fingers, using carbons and smoking Player's Navy Cut like something out of the front page. My world in Acton felt secure and solid compared to the world my parents had left behind. The Balkans would intrude only occasionally with the arrival of one of my grandmothers, dressed from head to foot in black. We would collect them from Victoria Station, accompanied by the terrifying crescendo of a departing steam engine. They arrived with, to my eyes, embarrassing gifts: a whole roast suckling pig wrapped in brown paper, boxes of sugary cakes and alien vegetables, and they stayed just long enough to get on everybody's nerves. For my parents, both citizens of countries that had ceased to exist before they started school, who then owed allegiance to another state that also vanished, and who became citizens of yet another state when they eventually secured British nationality, the questions of identity and belonging were constant issues. Year after year, they had to have their passports stamped by the Home Office in London with the precious words, "Granted leave to remain." Understanding that made me realise how their experiences have coloured my own preoccupation with understanding how buildings and everyday objects shape our sense of who we are. It made me see, beyond the narrow world of design, just a little of what it must feel like now to be an asylum seeker, a member of a more visible migrant community caught between identities.
Dejan Sujic was reading from his new book, B is for Bauhaus. The book is abridged by Polly Coles, produced by Clive Brill, and it's a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1. Now here's the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency, a 0015, today Friday the 18th of April. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Bailey, Faroes and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. High 250 miles west of Seoul, 1027, expected Dogger, 1022 by 1800 Friday. Low southern Norway, 995, expected North Germany, 1011 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking. North 6 to gale 8, backing south 5 or 6, decreasing 4 for a time. Showers at first, rain later, good. North Utsira, South Utsira, East 40s. Northerly or north.